From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Every child starts out as a natural-born scientist, astronomer Carl Sagan used to say. So why do so few become practicing scientists as adults? Science elder statesman, Grand Master E.O. Wilson has some ideas about that and some advice for young would-be scientists in a new book of very direct advice. Hold on to your passion, he says, for bugs, for stars, for dinosaurs, whatever it is on the scientific front, and never let go. He's with us today, this hour on Point, E.O. Wilson's advice for young scientists. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. What do you think? Are you a scientist in the making? Are you considering going down this path, becoming a scientist? Have you done it? What's your question for E.O. Wilson? What do you think of his advice? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now in the studio is E.O. Wilson, biologist, naturalist, Pulitzer Prize-winning author twice, now sage. He's known as the father of the field of sociobiology, the world's leading expert on ants, professor emeritus and honorary curator in entomology, that's bugs, at Harvard University. His new book is Letters to a Young Scientist. It's pretty terrific. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. E.O. Wilson, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be here with you again.
You say in here there's so much I want to talk about, and we'll get to some of what's going on in the great world of insects and nature, but these careers are important. You say you describe yourself as approaching the end of more than 60 years of research, and I just want to start off by saying, say it ain't so.
Oh, well, the 60 years is so, but unless we have some kind of life extension breakthrough in medicine, chromosomal changes and the like, then it'll probably be the case for me that I don't have many years left.
83. So you're turning around to look at the young'uns, those coming up.
42 years of teaching at Harvard.
And a lot.
And then, I've been a lot with high school students, so I've been with undergraduates as a chief advisor of many, and then graduate school and postdoctoral students as well, I felt gave me a kind of experience and feel for the subject that I shouldn't just let pass. And I decided to look into my own thoughts and find out what I had found successful and most satisfying and to put it into a book. So I put this book is in second person, confidential.
Talking to you,
tone.
Young person.
Exactly.
Yeah. I really appreciate your doing this. I mean, I wish people did it more often at your age to take that sort of collected insight into what it takes to do A or B or C and pass it on, share it down. You do it just wonderfully here. We'll get to your advice for the individuals, and this is really written as if to one young person in many ways. But what about the overall challenge? Is this a moment where we need extraordinary encouragement of young scientists? Why?
Well, you said it just right. I think that everyone now is aware that the United States in particular is falling behind, or it's failing to keep up with the rest of the world, the best educated and more ambitious developed countries at least, in science education, and thereby as well technological education. And we are, I don't know where we are exactly, but I think it's between Burkina Faso and
Let's hope.
And Paraguay.
No offense to Burkina Faso, but
no,
I think
not
we're still
at all. And, but anyway, everyone agrees that we're not doing it right, that we're not drawing enough young people into science and technology. But beyond that, I find it even more serious that we're not drawing the American public into the proper kind of understanding of what science is, what's happening in the world. Now we're into the techno-scientific revolution and the hyper-connection revolution that's sweeping the whole world and it's changing everything faster and faster. And we're not giving enough thought to the education of the general public from grammar school on up on what is happening and what science and technology really mean and where they're leading us.
If we could, let's go to the very basics here, because you do. We'll get to the advice, but let's start. I mean, you asked the question yourself at your great age and stage. What is this grand enterprise called science that has lit up heaven and earth and empowered humanity? How do you answer that question?
Well, I answer it as a discovery that was made. Let's give credit in Western Europe in during the Renaissance, but especially afterward. It is a method of investigating nature and of obtaining testable, realistic descriptions of phenomena of all kinds in the real physical world. And this method demands that there are propositions to be made that are testable, that others confirm or disconfirm, and that it has some elements of what I call consilience, that is, an ability to fit what is discovered and evidently verified by this stricter test of scientific rigor, how it can be integrated into the rest of knowledge, how it connects up with the rest of knowledge.
With everything else. Organized, testable knowledge of the real world, as opposed, you write, to the endlessly varied beliefs people hold from myth and superstition.
Yes.
So there we get science. And right now, as you remind us, we're in the middle of what you call the techno-scientific revolution. Define that for us. What do you mean by that?
I think everyone intuitively understands what I mean by that, now science, the great reductionist, primarily reductionist enterprise that swept into the culture in the 19th century and intensified exponentially. In fact, scientific knowledge has been literally doubling, according to discipline, every 10 to 20 years since that time.
For centuries,
and measurably since the beginning of the 20th century, with a result now that the world of learning has as a very large part of it accessible knowledge, which is based upon the scientific method. And this is affecting everything we do and think about. And the final redoubt, I believe we can say, that has got our attention at the present time in pure science is in brain science. We've explained almost everything else, or we've built the outlines of explanations of just about everything else. We've taken it all the way to the last more mysterious particles of theoretical physics and the nature of dark matter. And then at the opposite extreme, we have explored now the cell and the macromolecule structure of the cell to such an extent that we see how the whole thing probably works, although we haven't got it all figured out as to how it can be put together. But now attention is coming to that last redoubt, which is the brain and the nature of consciousness. Even Darwin foresaw that when he said that the mind is a citadel which will not be taken by direct assault. So we've had to come at it from many directions, and that's what modern neuroscience is. So we now are at that level, and it is time that we begin to make this available, both as part of general education that starts in the earliest grades, but also especially, and this is a subject, pardon me, of my own book, my book of advice, drawing the best and the most, I want to say gifted, yes, gifted, but the most committed, passionate young people to be part of it now.
We've just got a minute and a half before the break.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get to that advice. It's tremendous. But what about young people? They're smart, and they're watching, and they may be listening to you and thinking, well, gosh, it sounds like, you know, we're down to the last readout. It sounds like it's just a mopping up operation left for science. Most of the great stuff is already discovered, done.
No, there's always more and more to be discovered. I shouldn't have used the word readout so that, you know, in the image of scientific troops like the...
it's not the armies of the night.
Like the fall of Constantinople.
Right.
And victory then for Islam. Yeah. Not at all. I should have meant that the opening up of a whole series of phenomena that are made accessible by experiment and by new insights coming from other branches of science.
So it's not too late to get in the game.
Oh, no. If you will come into now comes the recruitment,
yes,
that you will allow me.
Yes.
If you will consider coming into biology and taking up the subject of biodiversity, then we know at the present time 1.9 million species, the vast majority, plants, animals, microorganisms, vast majority are unknown. And we think at least 4 or 5 million species still out there completely undiscovered.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Little sound of cicadas there, a huge crop of them emerging any day now, billions and billions. To cite a phrase, in an extraordinary crop this year. E.O. Wilson is with us this hour, biologist, naturalist, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, now elder wise man of science. He's got some important, deep advice for would-be young scientists in a really terrific little new book, Letters to a Young Scientist. E.O. Wilson is with me in the studio. You're 83 now. Mm-hmm. Big crop of cicadas coming out. Does it still excite you, or is it just another bunch of bugs?
Oh, it excites me greatly. It's, we can make a good point out of that. Incidentally, in order to anticipate a question that might come up, why do they do it all at once? This is what we call...
All these cicadas coming out in such vast numbers this year.
Yeah, vast numbers, and then they go on the ground for 17 years where the nymphs feed and grow. Answer given by ecologists and evolutionary biologists is called... predator saturation. In other words, cicadas are delicious.
Yeah, okay. I'll take your word for that.
Actually, some people do eat them.
Yeah, no doubt.
But certainly birds and mammals find them as
yummy.
A kind of insect. Just wonderful.
Yeah.
But if you have a certain number of predators out there, your enemies, one way to avoid them is to... join in a great mass movement, either come out at the same time or move together like a fish school.
Some will die, but many more will live.
Exactly. Just by coming out and being social. All right.
The absolute ingredient number one that you cite here, and you say it's even more important than training, as important as that is passion for something in science. And I guess the first question that comes up is, how does a young person know? As we quoted Carl Sagan saying, every young person is in a way a scientist in the making because they look around at the world and they're amazed. They're fascinated. But you say look to a passion that goes beyond just kind of general fascination with gazing out.
I believe that we ought to recruit young people into science and technology in the same way that we encourage some young people, sometimes at a very early age, to come into music or art when they show a desire to be involved. When a child is shown a piano and shown how to do a simple tune, sits down, and you have to pull them away from it,
mm-hmm.
that's a good sign.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we should be looking for in children. And young people should be looking for that in themselves. There is not an area of science that cannot be approached that way. That's a dream. I even outline what I call the three archetypes that thrill the human mind for the adventure they offer. And I'll just list them for you.
Yeah.
We won't have time to go into it. But what does the adolescent mind thrill to? variously great stories and archetypes and great stories and epics. They are, as I label them, the Lost World, the Holy Grail, and finally the war between good and evil. I've just summarized about 90% of Hollywood epics, but the point is that we're on the same soundtrack there. Young people really should be enthralled soon after they learn about certain aspects of science that intrinsically interest them according to their personality and what they feel they would most like to do.
It happened to you.
Yes. As a kid, I was an only child, and I got we moved around a lot. My father was very peregrine and moved from one job to another.
Mobile, Alabama, Washington, D.C.,
Alabama,
back to Mobile.
Mobile, Alabama, all these places, yes. And so usually I found that the one thing that gave me continuity was the outdoors. And I became an outdoor freak. And I went through the Boy Scouts up
a
the Eagle in record time.
And an ant watcher.
And all that good stuff. Yes. By the time I was 16, I decided, even earlier, the thing for me was to become an entomologist. I want to do that more than anything else.
Bugs.
Yes. And you know, the concern about these, if you have concern about or interest in these archetypes, I wanted to go to the lost world and discover new species in distant jungles. And I wanted to see great things happening because of this kind of work being done. And that was a dream that carried me on through. Well, there are 1,000 possible dreams. There are 1,000 possible early incidents and predispositions. So I would have to qualify Carl Sagan's remark by saying that I believe a majority of young people have the capacity to go into science and technology at a pretty high professional level, the majority, and maybe a considerable majority. But the way they should do it is not what I call the Paris Island mode.
What does it mean?
By that I mean you tell the youngster, as far back as grammar school actually, you're going to learn science. We have these science courses. Now, what you've got to do is learn math. Shall we say you've got to learn how to dismantle your rifle and fire it accurately. Then we're going to take you through biology. You got to know some biology.
Yep.
And then you get that biology, but behind you, in order to understand it deeply and, we might make this come first anyway, you've got to have some chemistry and physics. So we get you through there. And then maybe if what you'd like to do is something in biology, we'll end up there, and you can be doing that.
You're saying nuts to that path, but that's the sort of
that is a standard path, it's completely wrong. What we should be doing is encouraging young people to learn science according to the interests they develop.
Okay.
Of course, we should have informational courses that go through the principles, giving a basic literacy. But you've got to involve the youngster who shows an inclination, a talent, early, and encourage them in. And I have a little saying I like to quote. I think I got it from a Chinese fortune cookie.
Okay.
Maybe someone could give me a respectable 18th
citation.
Century philosopher who may have said
Bacon.
But at any rate, it's very good. It says, "You teach me, I forget. You show me, I remember. You involve me, I understand." So what we're talking about here is programs of teaching and encouragement of children individually. And you don't have to really spend hours with every kid. I mean, you don't want to have to break the budgets of school and education departments or universities to do this. And you encourage them by what they have, they most would like to do.
You're particularly relaxed about math. You write, if you're a bit short on mathematical training, even very short, relax.
Yes. I point out that some of the most gifted present-day mathematics, you don't have to go back to Darwin or to any of the great of the 19th century to find people who did great work in science. To be fluent in math is not necessary. It is not a checkpoint in science that you have to qualify with some degree of mathematical fluency to come on in. The image of the major scientist who's standing at a blackboard with writing
Fermat's theorem
formulas with a piece of chalk is a myth and terribly misleading. I point out and I've had backing from a good many mathematicians and others in making this statement that we need to get a little background as we go along in it. Mm-hmm. But the important thing is to learn everything about the field of science that we most want to go into and we're thrilled by. Now, in the case of particle physics,
okay,
molecular biology,
better
information theory.
Better know your math.
Yes.
Okay.
You've got to be fluent in math.
Yes.
But if you're not, don't worry. Find the field. If you can't, don't see yourself as gifted or able to learn this language. It is a language, you know. It should be taught early. But if you haven't had that kind of background, then go into a field, and there are a vast array of them, in which you can find excellence.
What about the very particular path that a young scientist follows? I mean, you had a passion for entomology, for bugs, but you made your name ultimately in ants, a very particular thing, and then this kind of sociobiology approach. What about choosing the particular path? I imagine some may be overwhelmed, not know which way to go.
It's important, I think, to have particular subjects that you work on. That's part of being involved. A good teacher, in my view, in science and technology, would take a student who's, say, showing an intense interest in, shall we say, the bacteria of polluted lakes. That's happened.
Okay.
And say, well, I don't know much about this subject to the student, but I'll tell you who to go see, and I'll tell you about the textbook I've seen that you can start with. And let's see what you can do with this subject. And similarly, you're fascinated by robotics. Mm. Well, that's certainly outside my field. Well, would you see so-and-so in the same school? Or I'll give you a person to go visit. Maybe you can even get a job in that person's laboratory.
Your advice is to go for unpopular or thinly populated fields of science. Why?
One of the principles that I present in the book is the reverse of the military dictum for a lost battalion or soldier, which is march to the sound of the guns. To the young scientist planning a future, even at a fairly early stage, I say march away from the sound of the guns. You don't want to go to the area or get into the area. Maybe you do in order to get some training, mm-hmm. some experience, make connections. In which the leading people have been delineated, the prizes given, the major advances celebrated. You want to know about them and learn about them, be inspired by them, but you want to find an area where there is little action going on.
Like what right now? Do you have any micro suggestions along that line or general advice on, you know, what? There may not be a lot of gunfire around X, Y, or Z, but that's promising looking?
Yes, I can suggest, for example, the one I just mentioned earlier. This is a poorly explored planet in the living world. We don't know more, even to having given a scientific name, to more than a small fraction, maybe as few as one-third, one-fifth of the species that are actually on planet Earth.
Seems like we've been at that for a long time, since the
18th century. Well, we haven't drawn enough good scientists into it to change that. And we're only recently developing the technology to do it more rapidly. So let's explore this planet. That's one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Another one that I made a suggestion some years ago, rather prominently, and won the hearts of the microbiologists. I said that if I had it to do all over again, maybe it wouldn't be ants. Maybe it would be microbial ecology. Let's get down mm-hmm. to the students,
really small.
You can say. Mm-hmm. Let's get down to the very small, not only finding out what's there. Did you know we only know or have names for about 10,000 bacteria, and there may be 50 million, 100 million kinds, and we know almost
the dark matter of biology. You've called it so much of it, the dark matter.
The dark matter. Thank you. And also, we know even less about the communities of bacteria and the ecosystems and so on. So I said, if I could do it over again, I would seriously consider microbiology, but I would go straight for ecology and the ecology of microbes. There are 1,000 wonderful careers about to open in just that one field alone.
E.O. Wilson writes, once you've settled upon a subject you can love, your potential to succeed will be greatly enhanced if you study it enough to become a world-class expert. The goal is not as difficult as it may seem, even for a graduate student. If the subject is thinly populated, if you're out there where not many are, right, you can become that. But E.O. Wilson's new book is Letters to a Young Scientist. He's with us. We have so many callers for you. Let's begin to go to them. Sarah in Virginia Beach, Virginia. You're on the air with E.O. Wilson. Sarah, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I'm majoring in biology at ODU. I'm getting my bachelor's next year, and I'm finding that there isn't a whole lot of job availability, and I would like to get my master's or go more specifically into a certain subject, but that doesn't make you more marketable. So what would be your advice on how to find a job with a bachelor's in biology?
I think what you need is a what kind of biology would you most like to be engaged in?
Well, I wanted initially to do some kind of research with animals, you know, working with the USGS or something of that sort, but there isn't a whole lot of that around this area.
Say that again. Animals and what?
The USGS, Geological Survey, is that to animals?
I think what you should do is get some kind of counseling on this, either by a professional counselor on employment, particularly in science, or people who are in that actual field. Go to them, talk to them, get their advice. If they tell you that if you're willing to get a master's degree, if they say something like, well, I give you about an 80% probability of getting a job in that field when you graduate with a master's degree, if you will go ahead and get a PhD, I guarantee you'll have a field. I think in the relation between biology and geology, there are so many areas that are opening up specialties, new problems in science and so on, that a PhD, and I hope you would at least consider that, will ensure that you'll be able to get a job without leaving the area you most like.
Is that your general advice? If someone wants to be in science, go all the way for the PhD? It can seem like a long path.
That depends. Mm-hmm. You know, I've, of course, to keep it simple, we've been talking about science as basically research, making discoveries,
yes,
being involved in the teams that are doing the great things in medical schools and in the particle accelerators and on, the ecologists in the coral reefs doing research. That's what I've been addressing primarily, again, to keep it relatively simple. Mm-hmm. But consider this. When you have a background in science and technology, I would hope this is the kind of background you can get at any level, up to the bachelor's, you know, and including the bachelor's. But if you can go to the master's degree, then there are endless other professions in which you can take that knowledge. The media, administration, practical applications, advice, agricultural work, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you just need to do scouting to find out where those are and how you might reach that area.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sound of swarming bees there. A lot of concern about a bee die-off lately. Takes us near the realm of my guest today, biologist, naturalist, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, and now elder wise man of science, E.O. Wilson. He's got some important, deep advice for would-be young scientists in his new book, Letters to a Young Scientist. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Let me just ask you about the bees. Everybody's worried about this. Everybody's worried about so many things in the natural world,
you know,
these days.
Tom, I'm glad you brought the bees up. Because we can use this to underline my response to our first listener
Mm-hmm.
A few minutes ago. Mm-hmm. Here is a billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar industry. A large portion of American agricultural productivity depends on getting honeybees out there.
To pollinate.
To pollinate the crops. Not all crops need it, but a large portion do. And now they're dying off, and we can't figure out what the cause of it is. It's called colony collapse disorder. And a lot of scientific and technical effort has been put into finding out what is just going on. And the latest word, report of a committee that has examined all the evidence as close as possible, says we don't know exactly. It could be a lot of things, including pesticides. It included inbreeding. And we just don't know yet what's causing this potentially billion-dollar loss for America. Well, could I interest you, listener, there must be you out there somewhere,
yes,
in considering melittology for a specialty in science?
Melittology meaning study of bees,
bees
and the honey?
Yes, of the hundreds and thousands of species of bees. Did you know that there are native bees that can be nurtured in natural environments to take over part of the they're ground bees. They're not as ground-dwelling mostly. They're not as effective as honeybees. But on and on, we can find ways to get around the subject, to solve the collapse disorder. And it's a beautiful example, very contemporary, concerning everybody, of why we need more science. We need more people working in science.
And we need answers. May I ask, do you presume that the bee collapse disorder is human-caused?
Yeah. I think we'll finally find there the human hand is in there.
Even at that scale?
Yeah. You see what happens with a bee disorder, I realize that we've sidetracked your program, Tom.
No,
that's all right.
Fine. It's
well, the bee disorder really is... the problem is that the bees go out the way bees do. You know, the bees only live 40 or 50 days.
Yeah.
And toward the end of their lives, they become foragers. And they go out, and they have this remarkable sense of orientation and way of communicating where they find flowers and so on, that they bring out other bees. They go out, and they don't come home. So what happens is that the population of the beehive just diminishes.
You mean in the collapse disorder, they never
That's
come
back.
That's
what they mean.
That's what
the
happens.
The colony collapses demographically.
They just disperse.
Melittographically, or
yes,
whatever the word is.
Yes,
and we just honestly don't know. We need to, because this does involve such an enormous problem for people.
And food.
Well, that's what I meant.
And all of nature,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, that's right. We really should have the capacity to field hundreds or even thousands of scientists into it specifically to help them solve this problem. You know, we did this with the billion-dollar CERN reactor in order to demonstrate the existence of the boson, of the Higgs boson.
Yes.
You know, you have to ask, why can't we find the money to train, and draw people by the hundreds or even thousands just on this one problem?
That sounds like a place for passion, devotion to science that we could really use. Ben is calling from Keene, New Hampshire. Ben, you're on the air with E.O. Wilson.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My question for Dr. Wilson, and thank you very much. It's a great honor to speak with him, is I'm an undergraduate studying astrophysics. And my passion has always been for teaching and for continuing my research. And to that end, I know that I'll need a PhD, but that I'm looking there at least 5 years of graduate study, 3 to 5 more years of postdoctorate afterwards, and then the difficult battle to get tenure if I want to continue that. And my question for Dr. Wilson is, I've heard that this is becoming more and more difficult and more options are opening up in industry. Do you believe that possibly leaving academia might be is that giving up on, as you say, on my passion? Or do you think that pursuing science by any means necessary or any means possible is still just as valiant?
Would you tell me again what you're working on? I didn't quite get it.
Astronomy.
Astrophysics. Yes.
Astrophysics.
Astrophysics. Yes.
So stay in academe or go to industry. Does he have to sacrifice his passion? Can he pursue it by any means, in or out of the academic setting?
Stay with astrophysics, And then, you know, at the, as you do this, learn aspects of astrophysics. And, you know, including, for example, a subject that I'm just writing on right now, life on other planets, which is heating up fast, thanks to the ability to do mass spectrometry of exoplanet atmospheres. And then use, be prepared to use what you're taking out of astrophysics, even if you don't go for a PhD, to enter some active area that is employing young scientifically trained people. Now, that way you are going to have to do a little bit of searching around, but everyone has to these days. You should not think of yourself as bound by the nature of that specialty to an academic career.
And do you see stepping off the academic path, the PhD and tenure path, as a surrender of passion or a copping out, or can he pursue it richly, fully in industry?
Not in the least stepping off. Do I see stepping off as a retreat or anything else? You know, we are in the process of another revolution, and that's the online teaching evolution. And you're going to see developments in that, the improvement of online courses with entire courses being taught in novel and exciting ways that are going to change the nature of training at the secondary level and the college level. I don't think that the traditional, still 19th century career path of academic biology is going to be around much longer. So stay with your passion. Learn as much of it as possible. You know, pick out a part of it where there doesn't seem to be many people working and decide to become a world expert on that. You can do that. Basically, then have your mind open. Look around where you might get jobs where you could apply what you're learning. And then keep your options open. You might find yourself in a few years at NASA in front of a computer screen that's following the drilling of through the ice of Europa to look for life in the great ocean beneath.
Sounds like a good idea. It sounds like many ways to go there, and certainly not a strict adherence required to one academic path, Ben. But good luck with it. Morgan in Malone, New York. Morgan, you're on the air with E.L. Wilson.
Hi, Tom. It's a real honor. I just want to say a little bit about the jobs. There is a ton of science jobs out on the bachelor level in the area of consulting. That's basically enforcing regulatory rules for development. I've been a wetlands and wildlife biologist for 14 years now with a philosophy degree. And it's not as glamorous. It's not as in a lot of cases. It's not as interesting. But if you learn the subject matter, if you learn plants and soils, you can do wetland delineation. There's tons of jobs out there for wetland biologists.
Yeah.
And so I just wanted to give some encouragement to the non-geniuses out there that they can access science careers too.
That's a point very well taken, and it makes it even better than I thought I could make it, that here is a field, a whole domain, actually, of professional activity that has got to be built up. It does include, if you're interested in precisely in natural history, doing wildlife studies, being in the outdoors, we'll see a lot more of this occurring in maintenance of our natural areas.
We've got a Facebook question here from Lindsay. She says, what advice do you have for young scientists who are discouraged by the difficulties associated with making it as a bench researcher? I'm 28, have a PhD in neuroscience. After completing a postdoc fellowship on Alzheimer's disease, I decided to leave the bench to pursue a career as a scientific editor. This was in large part due to the sad state of funding for research, given the choice between spending a majority of my time pursuing elusive grant dollars and editing the work of others. I picked the latter, she writes. I learned more about a diverse range of topics I can work from home. But what about the grind of the bench researcher and the paucity of research funds available, so people are always scrambling for grants rather than doing the work?
Oh, yeah, there are two aspects to address here that are very well brought up. First of all, is a scandalous restriction on scientific funding from the state and federal governments. We are desperately underfunded. I'm not talking about the need for America to become a mercantilist state. I'm talking about the opening of pathways for young Americans to advance scientific careers. And a lot of that should be of an engagement, and support should come precisely where this lady, the listener, just put it. We've got to spring postdoctorates free from the bench. I think of it as the kind of like a slave ship. A prestige in many of the fields of science. This is true of molecular biology. Posse, my fellow much admired molecular biologist, but they build up these big teams in order to pursue a large, complex
problem. Lots of research, yeah.
Yeah, and that's this means often that you get assigned as a new PhD, a postdoc, to doing one particular thing, and it can be complete drudgery. It's the opposite of what, unless you just like working in teams and talking with 15 other excited people and while somebody's at the blackboard. I don't. Mm-hmm. But anyway, if you do, that's all right. But then basically it's a little bit like being assigned your bench and given an oar on a slave ship.
Stroke.
So, exactly. Faster. So-and-so, that other ship over there at Stanford just passed us. And
let's
if
go.
We don't pass it ourselves, we will wheel this out on the great goal. That's terrible. I hope that we will be able to find a way to reward enterprise in our young people, starting with a PhD.
B asks us on Twitter, how do you see the gender gap in science, especially for children at a young age? Is it changing? There has been the sense that there were male advantages here that were kind of baked in the cake. Is that changed?
I think it's changed. It needs more changing. But it was a long time ago that we saw at Harvard and elsewhere the number of the young women going into, say, the field of ecology, passing the number of men. There used to be a canard, well, ecology is not mathematical, and that's why they go in. But that turns out to be false, too. Some of the most brilliant mathematicians I know who have thrown their hand into ecology are women. Plus the fact that ecology as a science, it's one of the great ones of the future, incidentally, for both scientific discovery and the building of professions, so ecology has become increasingly sophisticated and exciting, with many major questions still wide open for the young entrepreneur.
Asuka writes to us. She says, Professor Wilson's advice seems good. Be guided by your intellectual passions. Don't be lazy. Be flexible. Be canny. But Asuka writes, she says, but why science rather than any of the other fields to apply one's intelligence? Why science?
The relationship between the sciences and the humanities is the one that we need to work on a great deal. I'm in the process of writing an essay now along with a couple that I'm doing. This is what I do in my advanced years, writing essays for the New York op-ed opinionator column in addition to writing about life on other planets, is trying to puzzle out the right thing to say about the humanities. And the title of the article that I'm working on this minute is called The All Importance of the Humanities. And it's to point out that as the techno-scientific revolution proceeds, as we get more and more sophisticated robots and robotry, to do work, to explore, to solve difficult problems and so on for us, then we are at risk of transforming ourselves into extension of our own instruments. And therefore, it is in the humanities that we need to preserve as all important, because that's what really distinguishes our species.
You write about passion and devotion. You write about emotion as distinguishing
yes, all
the
of these
species.
Things to be expressed in other ways, in art and new directions of philosophy and so on. But at the same time, I think we should be searching for ways in and out of the humanities to connect it more solidly with what's being discovered with science and what the problems that are emerging out of science and technology for humanity should be somehow incorporated in the considerations of in the creative arts, not just the broader range of humanistic disciplines.
So that 15-year-old young person listening right now, you're 83, you've been there, and you say, go, do it, go, go.
That's right, yes. I like to say, you know, here it is. Here is the here are the controls. Take them over now.
E.O. Wilson. His new book, it's really terrific. If you're a young person thinking about this or have one, they ought to read it. It's Letters to a Young Scientist. E.O. Wilson, we're grateful to you as ever. Thank you so much for your thoughts today and for everything you do. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Tom.
The wonderful scientist, E.O. Wilson, and the little Smokey Robinson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.